May it please the Court, Gail Ivins appearing today for Curtis Hill, who is the petitioner appellant in this case. I'd like to address both the certified issue that this Court certified and whether a co-issued issue on the uncertified claims that are raised in the briefing. The factual scenario in this case is pretty unique. We have a situation where there's a presumption that applies to the prosecution that it's not murder, it's not caused by the assaultive behavior. He'd already, at the time of the autopsy and the neuropathologist special evaluation, he'd already been convicted of the actual act that would be the act in the murder case. And the autopsy results from Dr. Singhania, without the specialized findings by Dr. Andrews, were inconclusive in terms of, you know, a multi-system failure. I mean, I've got all those cites in the brief of her saying, you know, there's all these things wrong with him. Let's send this brain that looks on its face to be perfectly normal for a specialized evaluation. Looking at that, I think without that, I have a little trouble on this autopsy confrontation clause issue, given what some of the cases have said. But if we sort of put Williams aside, since it doesn't have a single holding, and we look at the canon of Crawford and post-Crawford confrontation clause cases.
Is that why you didn't bother to cite Williams in your opening brief?
I don't know how that happened. I'm so sorry, Your Honor.
Well, I'm just curious because I really did think
really good reason, but no, I don't think that's why, because if I...
That's a good reason is what I was going to tell
you. It's a great reason, but it's not why.
It's not a good reason.
No, it would not... It's a better reason than the fact that I don't know why it's not in there. Oh. It's at least a reason. No, I mean... It's obviously in Dungo. It's in my client's CCA case. I have notes that talk about it. I do not know why it's not discussed.
The only reason I ask is that it seems to me that's your entire problem here, is that Williams kind of, whatever had been settled, got unsettled to the point now where I don't think it's fair for us to say to a state court that you idiots, what couldn't you understand about what the Supreme Court has told you?
No, and I understand that, Your Honor, and the COA was issued in this case, you know, post-Williams, and, you know, I've briefed it to the best of my ability, and I do sincerely apologize to the court that Williams is only discussed in my reply brief after the opposing counsel very appropriately pointed out that I had failed to discuss it. But taking Williams with its divergent approaches, I mean, either we say Williams standing alone as a decision that can't reach a conclusion with regard to how we're going to treat DNA, a report on DNA, and whether we're going to require the person at Cellmark who, you know, ran the test to come and testify or not, and we have, you know, four and four and one and different parts. A lot of the analysis, for instance, the primary purpose analysis in Williams is not in the prior cases in terms of why they hold that the cocaine certification and the DUI, blood alcohol level certification, is testimonial. I mean, if you look at that canon of cases and ignore Williams, not because you should, but because it doesn't have a consistent, clearly established holding.
But aren't those cases different? Because in both the cocaine case, without the report from the crime lab, you can't be convicted of cocaine. It's simply white powder. And without the breathalyzer result, you don't have a blood alcohol reading. I mean, those cases are different cases than this case.
Without Dr. Andrews' finding of DAI, then you have Dr. Singhania not able to reach a conclusion as to the cause of death. I get that it's a step removed. It is a step removed, but it is no less a critical fact that supported the important fact in this case, which is cause of death, when we have a presumption that it didn't cause the death.
So for a moment, let's say you can show there's a confrontation clause error and we have to think about harmlessness.
Yes.
So this what you're just speaking about, I think, goes to this harmlessness question. And I guess I'm not sure. I'd like to ask you more about this, because if the coma was caused by the attack and he's in a coma for 4 years, it seems like at the end of the 4 years, the coma is at least part of the cause of death, which goes back to the attack. Like, I have a little bit of trouble understanding how, even if there's heart failure or something else, it's not somehow caused by the coma, which was caused by the attack. And so I guess I'm not totally sure that this testimony is so critical.
Right, and I understand that. And I mean, I don't want to get into the uncertified issues, but they answered that question.
Well, how do they? Explain that then.
Well, the uncertified issues has to do with the two reports by Dr. Pastraka and Dr. Hiserot, where their opinion is that the death was unrelated.
But I thought it was heart failure. I didn't know that it was totally unrelated to the coma. I just thought it was unrelated to the trauma on the brain. Because the coma, if the coma is caused...
It's one of them. I'll look it up, Your Honor, and I apologize for not having the exact page in my head. But one of them said he would have died anyway, even if he had not been assaulted. I'm going to triple check that, but I believe at least one of the two experts has a pretty clear opinion that says, you know, even without that, he would have died. So if that's the case, then this piece, this DAI, you know, that was relied upon, obviously, by the two testifying experts, was an essential piece in the cause of death.
Can I follow up on Judge Friedland's question? Because
yeah.
I had the same issue. So I thought that the government's theory was that the victim contracted pneumonia as a result of an infection from the breathing tube. That was their theory, not like heart disease or whatever, but
right.
Pneumonia contract. No?
That is their theory. I will say that both Jugalian and Singhania, and if you know that I'm pronouncing them wrong, feel free to correct me, but I'm doing the best I can with those names. Both of them talked about how it was, you know, multi-system and there were lots of pieces, and this was a substantial cause, not like the only.
That's fair enough. So, but the key thing I thought was they're saying that the coma was caused by the head trauma, which we know resulted from the assault. And so I did not see why was the DAI diagnosis so critical to that causal chain?
Well, the DAI diagnosis is what tells us that the coma was caused by the assault as opposed to some other cause. He was lucid and awake when the paramedics showed up and talked to them and then fell into a coma. And he's an 81-year-old man who has multiple problems. I mean, I don't know that we can accept it as just 100% a given, especially, you know, in a case of murder,
it was
100% for sure the assault that caused the coma.
Okay.
Until we have the autopsy.
So why does the DAI diagnosis show that it was the assault that caused the coma?
The DAI diagnosis says that there was some type of blunt force trauma that caused this separation of the nucleus from, you know, I probably won't try to explain. I was a math major, not a scientist. And that at that point, your brain basically ceases to function and you are in a coma. So the DAI diagnosis tells you that once he had that happen to him, he's in a coma. So that's a piece of it. And then from the coma, the theory that they have is that, and then you are in a breathing tube and you develop pneumonia, and it's pneumonia that is the cause of death.
Okay, let's suppose that they didn't have Dr. Andrews' opinion at all, and the coroner, the deputy coroner, they give their opinion that, look, when there is a head trauma like this, often there's DAI, and we believe here that based on the facts and the injuries that we saw that there was DAI here, and DAI would have caused the coma. So really, I mean, how critical is Dr. Andrews' analysis at all in this case?
So Dr. Singhania, I believe, testified, and it's in her report, that on gross examination of the brain, there's nothing wrong with it.
Yeah, but there's still the research on DAI out there.
But that would be, on her part, that would be speculation, right? I mean,
be enough based on her experience as an expert.
I mean, but I don't know that as a scientist she would have said, I've been informed that he was assaulted. I didn't see the wounds, and this was 4 years ago.
My point is, isn't this even an easier case than Williams? Because in Williams, you had that DNA profile, which if you didn't have the DNA profile, you really wouldn't have any profile to match Williams' DNA, too, once they find that. So this seems like an easier case of Williams, and yet you're stuck with Williams. The confusion that emanates out of the 414 in Williams.
Right. I mean, I guess the in terms of whether Dr. Singhani and Dr. Duglion would have been able to provide testimony as to cause of death being the head trauma that led to the coma, that led to the breathing tube, that led to the alleged pneumonia, going back to my uncertified issues. Their reports don't say that they would have been able to do that without Dr. Andrews' findings. So it's essential in that way. We don't have that fact.
Do you want to speak to the uncertified issues directly?
I would love to speak to the uncertified issues.
Yeah, because you're just running low on time.
This is a difficult case because there's so much that a lawyer could have done for Mr. Hill if they'd been appointed.
Can I just cut to the chase on my issue with your uncertified issues? So it seems like you're making an ineffective assistance argument about why a lawyer didn't uncover this evidence, but I don't see an ineffective assistance claim in the petition. Maybe he was asking to amend the petition, but when the magistrate judge rules you can't, basically, because you didn't make any explanation of why you didn't do this sooner, he doesn't object to the magistrate's order saying, well, here's why. And so at this point, I'm not sure what we're left with that allows us to say there's even an IAC claim really in this case at this point.
So he says in his objection to the reports and recommendation, basically what he's been doing all the time is, hey, I had a lawyer who briefed this, and it must be good. And I don't know anything, and I'm less than a layman at law, and I need a lawyer to professionally object.
But and if, when the magistrate judge says there's this newly discovered evidence that we don't know why it wasn't given earlier, he doesn't say, well, I didn't have it, or
no,
it just happened, or someone lied to me about it, or the government hid it, or anything like that.
No, he doesn't say anything. He responds not at all other than asking for a lawyer.
So how is it an abuse of – I think we'd have to say it's an abuse of discretion for the district judge not to have allowed him to amend even despite the lack of explanation. I mean, how do we get this claim even into the case?
Because
it's not in the petition.
That's true. And if a lawyer had been appointed at that stage, the lawyer would have filed an amended petition, raised the IAC claim, raised a Brady claim, and raised all of that, moved to stay, and gone back either, on a Ryan stay to exhaust, or would have argued that Martinez versus Ryan, excused the exhaustion, or Shalhoub v. Dello excused the exhaustion, and they would have litigated it. And so a lawyer would have known what to do. He not only didn't know what to do, how to respond to the judge. And my argument in the uncertified issues has to do with both. Obviously, he needs evidence because the judge has said, hey, you were dilatory. And he's got that, received 10-15 on it, which if that's true is not super dilatory because he filed it like 2 weeks later. And he needs to do discovery to prove up his appellate lawyer didn't turn it over to him and before then. He didn't have a copy of it. He didn't know about it. I mean, those are all things
Is it at this point a second or successive petition that needs to be brought? I mean, I'm just struggling with how this case has this issue in it at this point.
Two reasons. One is Rule 6 requires appointment of counsel under the habeas rules if necessary for the effective utilization of discovery. He asked for a lawyer. A liberal, pro se liberal interpretation would be he asked for a lawyer to help him respond to the things that the judge said, including, you haven't given me a good enough reason to rely on this evidence, number one. And number two is the fact that I've argued they mishandled the newly discovered evidence entirely. There's no ruling, by the district court judge on the request for counsel, so no one ever ruled on the request for counsel. So I do think there are at least three ways laid out in the briefing where this court can get to a point where it says, we're going to reverse and remand and ask the court to appoint counsel. And then at that point, it's not a successive petition. It's an amended petition with some procedural hurdles. But they're all handleable. including obtaining a copy of Dr. Andrews' report, which answers some of the questions.
So in order to get to where you want to go, do we have to say it was an abuse of discretion to not allow him to amend at the time?
No, the district court judge would do all of that. I mean, what this court needs to do is either say that it was erroneous for the court to treat the newly discovered evidence the way it did.
But what was erroneous about it? It was an abuse of discretion to not count it as an amendment, or what? It was
abuse of discretion to not liberally interpret his, like, here's some newly discovered evidence, please consider it, as requesting that the court, you know, consider that as either a claim or not, or inquire. But I think the stronger argument, frankly, Your Honor, is that when he asked for a lawyer, he should have been given a lawyer.
But so you'd say we remand just on an error that they didn't appoint counsel?
Yes, and then let counsel deal with all these very complicated issues.
Don't you have to show due diligence?
Yes. Yes, but he was unable to show due diligence, although I would say it helps that he has that received date on the documents. And so there is at least an inference available in the record that he was diligent. Because if that received date that's on those copies that were obviously faxed to his appellate lawyer much earlier, according to the fax stamp, if that received date is correct, he was diligent. And it was appropriately submitted newly discovered evidence that's incredibly relevant in terms of what it says about the reliability of the testimony that convicted him and put him in prison for the rest of his life. So I'm way over my time. I apologize.
So we will still give you a couple minutes for rebuttal. Let's hear from the state.
Good day, Your Honors. May it please the court, Christopher Beasley, Deputy Attorney General, on behalf of the respondent. The Williams case is what we've got. It's the state of the law. And in light of that law, how could the Court of Appeal here be unreasonable in the application thereof? The Court of Appeal had a set of facts that was similar to what was at issue in the Williams case, with an expert testifying at trial and relying upon the report of a non-testifying expert, just like in Williams. And the Williams court, though in a 4-1-4 kind of decision, said that's not a confrontation clause violation. The Court of Appeal concluded, we don't have a confrontation clause violation here. And that cannot be unreasonable under the AEDPA standard of review.
Well, what about just two distinctions that one could draw between this case and Williams, but you tell me why they might not matter. Number one, I do think the Williams plurality at least put some emphasis on the fact that that was a bench trial, right? And so the mental gymnastics that one is asked to do in this kind of case, don't take the non-testifying expert's report as for the truth, just somehow rely upon it and evaluating the weight to give the testifying. I mean, that's a kind of a crazy thing to ask anyone to do, even a judge. But the court was willing to kind of engage in that because it just said a judge can handle that. It seems reasonable to say maybe jurors. Why in the world would we think jurors could do that effectively? So that would be one. And then number two would be just that what seemed to give the court some comfort in Williams was that when the non-testifying expert created that profile, there wasn't any suspect that one could kind of have any motive to fabricate the results of that, right? Because you just don't even know who it might match up to. Whereas here, when Dr. Andrews is asked to give this opinion, they very much know what it's going to be used for, right? So anyway, those are just two obvious distinctions, but you tell me why they...
Sure. I think with respect to the first distinction, whether it's a judge or a jury, I agree, Judge Watford, that the mental gymnastics are virtually impossible. In fact, the California Supreme Court recently has said, no, when experts testify and they rely upon other expertise and things, that is offered for the truth of the matter asserted. The People versus Sanchez is the name of that case. So the California state courts recognize that it is offered for the truth of the matter. But whether something is offered for the truth of the matter doesn't answer whether it's testimonial. And so even though that there's that mental gymnastics, there's still the question, is it actually testimonial? Only if it's testimonial do you run into the confrontational clause violation. And here we don't have, it's not necessarily testimonial.
But why? I mean, so you have a specific suspect here.
Right.
And it's a formal signed report. So it seems like, can't you piece together the opinions in Williams and actually say that it is irreconcilable with Williams to say what the court said here?
I would disagree with that because, first, we have to look at Dr. Andrews. There's no evidence in this record that Dr. Andrews, who was a consultant for just the brain, that he knows any of the facts as to this case. There's no evidence that he was provided anything other than, here's a brain. Please tell us what you can find in it. There, we have nothing suggesting that he's looking for anything, that he... We don't even know that whether he offered a cause of death. We don't know anything about
it. Does that introduce another factor that the U.S. Supreme Court hasn't talked about? I mean, this idea that is there a specific defendant, do we have to – maybe I'm just forgetting that part of the opinion, but I don't remember this idea that you don't know that any suspect is there when you're doing a DNA test really went to, like, subjectively whether the person doing it knew there might be a suspect or not.
Well, no, I don't think it's quite that fine as far as, you know, you have to know that there's an identifiable suspect. But the primary purposes is that it's for a criminal investigation, and the statements at issue, the person offering those statements needs to understand that it's for the purposes of a criminal investigation. And when we deal with autopsies in California, they're for a whole myriad of different reasons. And when we have a person that's removed from the actual autopsy, a person who's a consultant who's being brought in,
Once they think there's blunt force trauma, then don't they think maybe this is criminal? And they write a report and they sign it and it's formal. I mean, at that point, it's not testimonial.
That would be the people conducting the autopsy, but that's not necessarily true of the person who's being consulted with a brain. Here's a brain. Tell us what you can find in it. We don't know what he was told. We don't know that he was given any information beyond here's a brain. Please use your expertise as a neuropathologist.
But are you saying that someone who looks at the brain, Andrews, looks at the brain, thinks this brain has been hit, that doesn't lead Andrews to think maybe there's a criminal issue here?
I don't think that that's necessarily what happens. I think that all he does is objectively evaluate, does the microscopic analysis, figures out there's sequelae throughout this organ, which is the scarring, and there's the diffuse axonal injury, and then he sends back a report saying, this is what I found. It's for then the testifying witnesses, the autopsy, the person who conducted the autopsy, Dr. Sinjania, and then her supervisor, Dr. J, that they then are able to connect the dots and say, this is what we were told, that this brain has DAI or sequelae, and this is what...
Are you saying basically DAI can be caused by something that's not at least possibly criminal? I mean, I guess you can fall, but I mean, once you have DAI, isn't there at least a... good chance that this is because there's some...
It's possible, but the thing is that when Dr. Andrews first does his examination of the brain, we don't have any evidence that he knows anything about this brain other than here's a brain, study it. When he finds what he finds and writes a report and says, here is what I found, it's not for the purpose of anything other than to inform what he found. It's not for the purpose of criminal prosecution. It's not for the purpose of anything other than what he's been asked and contracted to do, which is to advise the persons that have asked him to do this analysis.
That's true of the drug test person. That makes no sense to me. I mean, the person who's evaluating the cocaine is only doing what they're asked to do. They test the cocaine.
Except that cocaine is an illicit substance in and of itself.
But
you know?
Before they got it, it's only white powder, and they don't know until they've tested it, and they're just doing what they're asked.
Yeah, I can see your point. I can see your point. But I mean, this is why the Williams case is a difficult decision, because it doesn't provide any real clarity in this area of the law. And that's why, I mean, what was the California Court of Appeals supposed to do with a decision like Williams in light of Crawford, Melendez-Diaz, Bullcoming, and Williams? It can't ignore Williams. It just is applying the law as it stands. And what was unreasonable about that? There was nothing unreasonable. So, yeah, we can take a step back and we can start looking at primary purposes. There's nothing in this record suggesting that Dr. Andrews' primary purpose in analyzing his brain is anything other than just making observations. And then as far as formality and solemnity, autopsy reports have not ever been held to be the formal solemnity kind of documents like certified lab analysis certificates at issue in Bullcoming or in Melendez-Diaz.
What is the possible difference, though? They're like exactly the same.
Well, but the thing is that there's an autopsy, I don't know. It's mental gymnastics. They're different, though, in that an autopsy report of this nature, with because we're looking at Dr. Andrews specifically, his report is not a report as to cause of death. I agree that what Dr. Jugilan or Dr. Sinanya's, their autopsy report
that would be formal solemnity kind of stuff, just the same as Melendez-Diaz and Bull Cumming. And had they not testified, we'd have a huge problem. But we're talking about Dr. Andrews here. His is not the formality and solemnity of theirs, cause of death. His is, these are my observations of this organ. Take it for what it's worth. And then we have Dr. Singhania's testimony, where she said, yeah, I got these observations from Dr. Andrews, and they were consistent with my observations. She testifies to that. And then Dr. Jugalan basically doing the same, saying, yeah, this is what I was told, that he had DAI, that this brain had DAI, and he's the one who ultimately explained what DAI is, and he's the one who ultimately explained what it can cause, and then ultimately rendered an opinion as to cause of death. So Dr. Andrews, his stuff is different from what Dr. S and Dr. J offered, because it's not an opinion, it's just plain observation.
Can I ask you a question? Do you agree with your opponent's assertion that without Dr. Andrews' DAI diagnosis, the two testifying doctors could not give an opinion as to cause of death?
I don't actually agree with that.
So why not?
The reason I don't agree with it is because of the facts of this case. We have here a man who is 70-some years old, who is punched in the face and kicked in the head, and then within a matter of a few hours slips into a coma. The doctors who did the autopsy, they could have rendered an opinion in much the same way that Judge Fischer suggested, that, look, here we have an old gentleman who was punched, kicked in the head, he slips into a coma, he's in a coma for 4 years, clearly that coma resulted from the fact that he was punched and kicked in the head, and then later, when he's on the feeding and the breathing tube, that's what gets infected, and that's what ultimately causes the bronchopneumonia, which is the ultimate contributing factor to his death. So I think that, yeah, Drs. S and J could have rendered an opinion without relying upon the expert, Dr. Andrews' observations.
They would just say, based on common sense, it stands to reason that someone who, because I think he was working that day, right?
That's correct. He was like there for his landscaping job.
Right. And that's so right. It just stands to reason that somebody who had this kind of trauma inflicted and within this period of time falls into coma, there's just got to be a connection. That's kind of what they would.
That's exactly right. And that actually also then goes towards our harmless error analysis, in that under Brecht, we're looking for substantial or injurious effect upon the jury verdict. And that's just not here under the facts of this kind of a case, even if this was testimonial, even if this should have been excluded under the controlling laws of the Supreme Court. It's not the kind of error that would have resulted in a substantial and injurious effect upon the jury. The jury would have reached the same conclusion, even had that evidence been excluded entirely.
You chose not to brief the uncertified issues. Do you want to say anything about them?
I would prefer not to.
Okay. You're certainly entitled to do that. Do we have any other questions on the uncertified?
Thank you, Your Honors. Okay. People would submit.
Okay. Thank you. Let's give defense counsel 2 minutes for rebuttal.
So I would ask the court for some type of opportunity to get Dr. Andrews' report into evidence in the lower court. And I'm not going to tell you what it says. But I really would like an opportunity, because it's not in the record, and if it were in the record, that would be helpful.
You're saying you do have it?
But I can't give it to you, and I understand that, but I would really, as a officer of the court, like an opportunity to get this into the record, which I could do if it were remanded on any basis that the court could come up with. Also, I just wanted to note, I didn't say this in my opening remarks, there's an argument about unreasonable factual findings, diagnosis versus observations, and of course we don't need clearly established federal law for that, and that's a very complicated issue. I'm not going to address it in rebuttal. Dungo and the Williams-Sprouty talk about primary purpose, and that's not in the other cases, and so the application of Dungo is not necessarily on all fours with the U.S. Supreme Court cases.
It sounds like California has moved away from Dungo anyway.
Yeah, but in this case, the Court of Appeal applied Dungo. If the court can't remand the case, if there's a way to extend my appointment, I would do the work. Or grant the COA, and let's have an opportunity to really brief those issues with the full engagement of the parties. Thank you.
Very much. The case just argued will be submitted, and we are adjourned for the day. Until tomorrow.
All right.